We're going to be back in 1 Samuel, big surprise. We've been going through the book of, there's two books. It's really one, but it's split into 1 and 2 Samuel. So if this is your first time here, we're in chapter 13. I'll summarize very quickly what's happened. We start off with Samuel's mother. She's barren. She can't have children. She cries out to God for a son. And God gives her one. She dedicates him to the Lord by putting him in the temple to live with Eli, right? Eli raises him in the temple to love and worship God and to be a priest, okay? Turns out Samuel is not just a priest, he's also a prophet. And God begins to speak to Samuel, and he becomes the last judge prophet of Israel. And the people rebel against God and demand to have a king like their pagan neighbors because they feel outmatched. They feel sort of left out. And they're afraid of their future. They're afraid of the leaders to come will do a bad job. And they may have done a bad job, but they don't trust God enough to deal with that. So they say, we want a king. And so they put in a new government system that they think is going to save them, a monarchy. And Samuel's job becomes to bring in the first king, and that first king that's chosen sovereignly by God is Saul. And Saul is a pretty mixed bag. He's a great military leader. He musters a really large army. We're going to see his army gets even bigger this morning when we look at what he does, but he's also deeply, deeply flawed and insecure. And we see the first sign of that at his coronation as king, when they call for Saul, because God chooses him, right, through that process of casting lots and narrowing it down, and finally they get down to Saul. And Saul is actually literally hiding in the baggage. And they have to go find him. God has to tell them where he is. He's hiding in the baggage. Oh, let's go find him. And they dig through, and there he is. You know, not me, right? And they drag him out, and they make him king, right? And so this doesn't go away. This problem doesn't go away for Saul. We're going to see that in pretty stark relief this morning with a pretty major mistake he makes. And it ends up really ending his dynasty as king. All right, we're going to see that this morning. So we're in 1 Samuel chapter 13. Let's read the first four verses here. Saul lived for 1 year and then became king. When he had reigned for 2 years over Israel, Saul chose 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent home, every man to his tent. Jonathan defeated the garrison of the Philistines that was at Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. And Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. Or it just means like, pay attention. Hey, pay attention. Look at this. And all Israel heard it, said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were called out to join Saul at Gilgal. Okay, a lot just happened. Okay, a couple years go by, 2 years go by in Saul's kingship, and he musters a fairly decent-sized army. Now, we're going to see in a minute, it's not that big, right? But it's big. They feel like this is pretty good. We've got a good group of soldiers put together, and we should note that Samuel's prophecy / warning to them about what a king would do is coming to pass. People are being called. One of the things was, if you get a king, he's going to have an army, and you're going to be forced to be in it. And we're seeing that come true, right? But he has an army, and this army is, there's one group assigned to Saul that he's in charge of, and then there's another group assigned to Jonathan, Saul's son, and he's in charge of that. Jonathan goes and attacks the Philistines. It's the first time we see Israel going on the offensive. Up until this point, they've been defensive. If somebody comes knocking at their door to destroy them, take their land, whatever it is, they'll defend themselves. And usually how that goes is God defends them. God intervenes. And they don't have to do a whole lot. They do a little bit, maybe. They just obey God, and he defeats their enemies for them. But now we have a different thing happening, which is Israel, Jonathan specifically, in the name of Saul, going on the offensive. He's picking a fight. And so he takes his 2,000 soldiers and he sees a garrison, a company of Philistine soldiers, and they attack him and they beat him. Can you believe it? Right? Now, you're going to see at the end of chapter 13, what makes this more amazing is that the Philistines did not allow anyone in the area to make metal, to form metal at all. They owned the rights to that. And if you tried to, get your blacksmith to make some swords or even shovels and stuff for farming, they would come and kill you. And so the only people, they could make things out of wood, and that's it. So they beat the Philistines with farming implements. They had to actually go to the Philistines to get them to make shovels and hoes. Hey, I need a spade. Can you make me one? Okay. And so the thinking is they might have sharpened those and made them into weapons. But this becomes a problem later. It's one of the big reasons why it adds a layer of interest, I think, complexity to the fact that they actually won this battle. With the only people that had swords, it says, is Saul and Jonathan, the king and his son. Everyone else was walking around with sticks and spears and maybe rocks. I don't know. It's pretty amazing. It's a big, big deal. So they beat the Philistines, this relatively small group of Philistines, and they're feeling pretty good, right? They're pretty excited. Saul's our king. This whole king thing is really working out, right? But wait, there's more. If you notice here in verse 4, it says, the other thing that's happened now, there is a consequence of this offensive, which is now the Philistines hate them. It says they are a stench to them. Up until this point, they've just been like a bug in their way that they can squash, but they don't really care about them. Now, they're mad. Now the Philistines hate, abhor. They a stench, that's like a bad smell. Have you ever had a bad smell in your house and you can't find it? And you're like, I just want to get that smell out of here. What is that? Is that some trash? Did a rat die in the wall? Like, what's going on? Are the cats still alive? Like, what's happening, right? And you're looking around and just all you want to do is get it out of your house. This is how the Philistines feel about the Israelites now. They have poked the bear and they have made it angry. And they're now on the radar. And there's no indication here whether or not God blessed this battle or not, whether or not he was happy about them. I think you could make a case that they just went off half-cocked and just did it without God's blessing, because there's no mention of God's blessing here. But I can't really prove it, so I'm not going to stake myself out on it. But what we can say is there's a very clear consequence, which is now the Philistines hate them, and we're going to see that play out here in verses 5 to 7. So let's look at that. Verse 5. And the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots. Not 2,000. 30,000! And 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. Just try to imagine. Use your imagination if you can. 30,000 chariots by themselves would look like. And then on top of that, how many? 6,000 horsemen, 6,000 guys on horses, which would be incredibly frightening when you don't have any horses. And then on top of that, a number too high to count of just foot soldiers. Like this, they said, like the sand and the sea. So thousands upon thousands upon thousands, more than they had chariots and horsemen. I don't have a concept of what it would be like to stand on the ground and look out and see that many people that see you as a stench that needs to be wiped off the planet. And to know that you just made them angry by poking them. That's what just happened. They have aroused their anger towards them. It says they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Bethaven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, they're in trouble, for the people were hard pressed, the people hid themselves in caves and in holes and in rocks and in tombs and in cisterns. And some Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. So his mighty army looks and sees the, you know, probably 40, 50,000 Philistine, angry, grumpy, irritable soldiers, and they scatter. They run. They hide in caves, in cisterns, which is where they would hold their water, right? In holes, in literally in tombs with dead people. They're hiding everywhere they can hide because they're going, oh my goodness, what have we just done? We're going to be wiped out. And so now Saul is in this horrible position, isn't he? I don't know if you've ever felt this way. I have. Where you feel like I've gotten all my ducks in a row and I can take on life on my own now. Right? You ever feel like if you just get everything in place, the right job at the right time, the right house, the right location, the right church, the right pastor, the right spouse, the right kids, whatever. They just get everything in place, you know, lined up and in order. Then I can handle my life. And what I really need is I need God and maybe the church to just help me get on my feet again. When I used to do drug ministry back when I was in college, I took a year off to do that. That was the most common thing. You see people come in with this horrible drug problem. They thought, if I could just get my addiction taken care of, then my life would be great. Not realizing that the addiction was just a symptom of other brokenness. And then you deal with the addiction and they found this seemingly bottomless pit of brokenness that needed to be healed and addressed. But they thought, if I could just get this one thing straightened out, then everything would be great. And then you find out that the army is far bigger than you thought it was. And you just want to launch out on your own. I got this now, God. I got a new job. Or when you're single, it's like, I'm finally married. I got this. And you go, I'm going to go poke the bear. Right? I'm going to go pick a fight. And you go out and you pick a fight. And you take on life on your own, in your own strength, under your own power, with your own ingenuity and work ethic. I got this now. Thanks for the leg up, God. I'm on it. And then you poke the bear and you turn around, you turn a corner, and you see this massive army. And you go, oh, wait a minute. And what do? If you're smart, you turn and you run back home where God is. Right? Right? Not so tough, are you now, right? How's that? I can just see God saying, how's that king thing working out for you? You thought it was going great. You thought you had it, didn't you? We figured it out. We just need this style of government with the right guy in place, and it's all going to be good. I'm not going political again today. I'm not going to do it. But that's, yeah, thanks, Alan. It does sound political. I'm steering left now of that, all right? God help us. I've been there. I really have. I think everybody in here has. The truth is, you will never have things together so much that you don't need God. Ever. You, on your absolute best day, if you've ever even had a best day, I don't know that I have, but on your best day, under the best circumstances, with the wind at your back, you are no match for your enemies. None. What are your enemies? Satan, sin, and death. That's what the Bible says. Those are your three enemies. Satan, sin, that's you, and death. You can't beat any of those by themselves. By yourself, you can't. On your best day, with the wind at your back, on top of your game, on doing everything right, making all the right moves, with all the right pieces on the board, you are no match for even one of those enemies. You can't even fix yourself, much less the world. And this is what they're seeing. You need God to fight for you. You will always need God to fight for you. Always. That will never be, it'll never change. Not just because you aren't having a good day, you need God. You need God on your best day, right? And you always will. And this is the lesson I think God is trying to teach them. They don't learn it too quickly. They learn it about as quickly as you do, right? So what does Samuel do? This will also feel very familiar. In this situation, imagine yourself, you've been in this situation before, maybe not with the Philistines, but you've been in this, you've felt this feeling before of your enemies in front of you are overwhelmingly large and impossible to beat. And so how do you respond in that moment? We're going to see Saul respond in the wrong way, right? Verse 8, he says, he, being Saul, waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. So apparently Samuel told him, wait 7 days. That seems to be sort of a standard for Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. Isn't that how it is? And Saul went out to meet him, probably really nervous because Samuel's a little intense. And Saul went out to meet him and greet him. Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, I imagine him sounding like one of my children when they were about 8 years old and they did something bad. The voice kind of goes up a few octaves, trembling a little bit, very defensive, but they know it's not working, but they're going to try anyway. What have you done? And Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you didn't come within the days appointed and that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash, I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. It's your fault. You weren't here. Oh, you don't understand how scary it was. All my soldiers were scattering, the few that I actually had. I didn't even have enough to begin with, and they're scattering, they're leaving. And while they're running off and hiding, the enemy's coming closer and closer and closer, marching in, and they're going to destroy us. And so I just did what I had to do. I took matters into my own hands. And Samuel's going, have you not learned anything? Right? Verse 13 says, and Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you. For then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. So what is Saul's big mistake? What's the big deal? I mean, isn't it good that he wanted to get God's blessing on the battle? I mean, isn't that a good, I mean, isn't he at least acknowledging that he needs God's help at this point? Maybe he wasn't before. I tend to think he didn't with the first battle. But at least now, isn't he doing that? Well, not so much. Let's look at why he did this, all right, what the problem is. Number one, the first reason why this was an enormous, not minor mistake, was that going to war at this time required the prophet to say if God would bless it, and then it required the king to execute it. There was a separation of powers here, okay? The king was not authorized by God to do it. The king was supposed to wait for the prophet to come and say, God says, go ahead and fight. And then the king would do it. And the prophet couldn't tell the army to go fight. He had to tell the king what God said, and the king had to obey God and execute the command. That's how it worked. So part of what Saul has done is he has broken the law about how you go do this. He has gone off and said, I'm not waiting for God to speak. This is the same mistake they made when they brought the Ark of the Covenant into battle and expected they could force God's presence to bless what they were doing instead of asking God if they should be doing it in the first place. And so they're treating God like another one of those pagan gods, those pagan idols, that if they just do the right blessings, then that God will bless what they're doing. And they treated God the same way, and he wouldn't have it. And here Saul's doing the same thing again. You know what? I'm not going to ask God by asking the prophet if he wants to bless this, if we should be doing this at all. Instead, we're in a bad spot, so I'm going to force it. I'm not going to ask God. I'm going to make God. And when you get into that mode of thinking, you get in big trouble.
And we can't be too harsh on him, can we? Because can't you see where you've done this yourself? You've been in a bad spot, and the enemies are closing in, and you feel overwhelmed. Instead of stepping back and inquiring of the Lord, you just say, well, I'm just going to grab my Bible, and I'm going to try to force God, manipulate God into doing what I want him to do. And it doesn't work. Second problem here is he did it because he was afraid of the Philistines. He was afraid because he did not trust God to be faithful. God's never late. Samuel wasn't late. It was God testing Saul. Samuel's not late. He's just later than he told Saul he would be. It's like when Jesus goes to Lazarus' tomb and they tell him, you were late. He's already dead. Does it matter? Jesus is never late. He's always on time. He's just not on your schedule. And Saul had set a schedule for God. God, you must come on this time. If you don't come at this time, I'm just going to be forced to take matters into my own hands. So here's your deadline, God. And whenever you give God a deadline, what does he do? He says, well, there's one day when I will not be coming, and that is on the day that you set. That's why I always laugh when people predict the second coming of Jesus. It's going to be on this day. Well, there's one day when we know he will not be coming. You have guaranteed that he will not be coming on that particular day, right? It might be the day after. That would be hilarious to me. Or even more funny, the day before. I can't wait for that. Somebody predicts the second coming and it happens the day before. And we're all like, ah, you know, be great. But he's not coming on that day. Don't give God deadlines. You just tell him, God, you're the creator. You're sovereign. You're the boss. And if you want to fight this battle tomorrow or today or yesterday or not at all, it's up to you. When you approach God that way, he blesses you. When you approach God trying to manipulate and push and force him to do what you want him to do, he doesn't respond well. Third reason why this was a mistake is I think I already said this. He's treating God like a force to have on your side, not a real God, like an idol. If I just do this ceremony, God will bless it. Completely missing the whole point of the ceremony, which is to hear from God in the first place, right? So Saul's insecurity is causing him to make devastating mistakes in his leadership decisions. He's self-sabotaging his own authority. He's getting in his own way. All he had to do was wait, another hour for Samuel to show up? And what does Samuel say would have happened if he had waited that hour for Samuel to come and say, God is going to bless this, let's do this. If he had waited that hour, God would have blessed not just him in this battle, but his entire lineage. He would have given him an inheritance to give to his son Jonathan, who would give him to his kids and his kids thereafter if he had waited on God that 1 hour. It's scary. So the consequence of this bad decision is not that Israel will be cut off. God's merciful on Israel. Because remember, he told them through Samuel, now that you have a king, not only do you have to be righteous and obey God, but your king does too. And if either one of you don't, I will not bless you. So he's being merciful by not saying, see, Israel, you shouldn't have wanted to have a king. I'm just going to wipe you out. We'll start over. Because that was the promise. But what he does is, instead, he cuts Saul off. Look what he says here, verse 13. Actually, we read that already. Let's read verse 14. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. Now that phrase gets repeated later. That's David. Okay. And the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal. The rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. They went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. And Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. So now we have
600 against 40, 50,000, maybe 60,000. We don't know how many. Saul has been disinherited by God because of what his insecurity caused him to do. So I want to point out to you, and I want to be careful here because I know if you're insecure, I don't want to make you more insecure, right? I don't want to, if you already have a complex, I don't want to give you more of one. However, insecurity is a much, much bigger deal than we realize it is. It will cause you to hurt people, which is a weird thing, isn't it? Because usually if you're insecure, you're sort of insecure about yourself because people have hurt you or not, at least not been encouraging. But what that insecurity tends to do is make you hurt other people and neglect people and destroy your life. This is what Saul is doing. I mean, if you knew Saul probably on a personal level, you would immediately feel sorry for him. You go, wow, Saul, just believe in yourself. Come on. You're king, man. You're king. Like, act like a king. Be strong. Like, you're the best looking guy around. You're tall. God chose you out of all of Israel. Sovereignly picked you. Like, believe in yourself. You would feel sorry for him. But the scripture never feels sorry for him. It just says, dude, you just blew up your whole inheritance. You could have waited an hour, man. Just an hour. And so it's a funny line we walked this morning, because I don't want to make the insecure people feel more insecure, but I want to push you a little bit, okay? Thinking little of himself led to thinking too much of his enemies. It made him easily intimidated and overwhelmed. So insecurity, I believe, fundamentally, is not just about not believing in yourself because you're flawed. It's because you don't think enough of God. We don't have a self-esteem problem fundamentally. We have a God-esteem problem. And this is very much counter to what the world tells you. The world tells you just believe in yourself. Well, what about for those of us who let ourselves down so many times that we have learned accurately that we will continue to be a letdown? That self-esteem message only works for people who already feel good about themselves. If you're already self-confident, that self-esteem, believe in yourself message works for you because you already like yourself, right? But for people who are broken and insecure and look at them and they've failed a lot, maybe sometimes really seriously failed, say that to that person, it just makes them bitter. Yeah, that works for some people, but you don't know me. You don't know who I am and what I've done or what's happened in my life. I'm a mess. And it just makes you more bitter. So stop saying that to people. Stop. I don't understand what we're doing when we put the word believe on a t-shirt. Believe in what? Can we just put like in Jesus on there? Like is the point of life, is that the answer to life? Is just believing in something? It doesn't matter, man. Just believe in something. What if you believe in something stupid? That's not going to lead you to a good place. It'll lead you to a stupid place because you believed in something stupid, right? Believing in yourself, what if you're a mess? Be yourself. What if being yourself, what if you're a jerk? Don't be yourself. You know, like, don't be a jerk, right? So it's like some of these platitudes we throw around that we hear in our culture and we put on bumper stickers and t-shirts and things and they get passed around on Facebook, you know, with cute music and little animations. They mean nothing. And so this self-esteem thing, for somebody who really is insecure, those kind of things just make them bitter. It doesn't help. The answer is not to think more of yourself. The answer is to think more of him. And that will transform the way you see yourself, right? It's a very different message. For Saul, thinking little of himself was a symptom of thinking little of God. And actually, Samuel says to him in chapter 15, I know you think so little of yourself, but I think it would be easy to simply dismiss Saul by just saying that he had low self-esteem, which is how this gets preached quite often. And at this point, I would begin to tell you to believe in yourself and you're going to be great. You're going to be a superstar. Maybe you could just be YouTube famous, but you might be famous. Right? I'm going to tell you how great you are. And then you'll leave here pumped up, and it'll take you about five to the, until the next failure for the wind to get completely taken out of your sails. Because I have given you an empty, false hope that you are the answer to your problem. And you are not the answer to your problem. If you look at Saul's actions, you will see a man that had very low God esteem, which led to very low self-esteem. He did have low self-esteem. That's true. But the reason for that is he didn't esteem God very highly. He looked at God like some kind of good luck charm force that was there just when he needed him to bless something. And when he thought he had things in hand, he ignored God. And he went off on his own. And he only ever ran to God when things were hard or scary or difficult. And then, even then, he didn't run to God in repentance, saying, "Oh God, what have I done? I've neglected you again. Please forgive me, restore us, that you would bless us again, that we would be strong." He doesn't do that. He goes to God and says, "I need you to bless me. This is bad." If Saul had been confident in the sovereign power of God, even in his being chosen as king, it's amazing. That story is amazing. If he had been confident in God's faithfulness, then Saul would have been able to accept his coronation without hiding in the luggage. He would have sought God's voice before going into battle the first time, and he would have been waiting for Samuel to come the second time. But he wasn't. So thinking little of God and therefore little of himself led to making fear-based decisions that cost him his entire legacy. So I think first of all we need to reject this self-esteem gospel outright. It's a false gospel. Humanism doesn't work. Humanism only works for people that have enough natural, inborn self-control and power over themselves and confidence. For everyone else, it makes them bitter and frustrated because it fails. So it makes arrogant people more arrogant and more prideful. And it makes broken people more broken and more discouraged. And you'd be surprised if you start to pay attention how much humanism has crept into the way we think about how to be Christians. Jesus never said anything like "believe in yourself." He said "believe in me," right? And even Jesus himself was not shaped by his own identity. He let the Father shape him. What he did and how he acted and how he saw himself was never even about him when he was on the earth. He made it about the Father. And if anybody had a right to make it about himself, it was Jesus. But he did everything for the Father, demonstrating what it looks like to be human to us. Jesus himself established his identity in the Father and not himself. So we deal with our insecurity by admitting our weakness as we learn to esteem Christ more each day. And the more you esteem him, the more you see yourself more clearly. So you look at Jesus and you go, "Wow, look what he's like. He died for me? So the price he paid defies my value." And not only that, but the gifts he's given me make me useful. Wouldn't it be nice to be useful? I have useful things he's given me, not because of me. He just gave them to me. It's like he wasn't even paying attention to who he was giving it to, because he gave it to me and I'm a numbskull. What am I going to do with this stuff? But he gave me these gifts. And these gifts can change the world. Not only that, but I can build an eternal kingdom with these gifts. So it's not even just this world. I get to change this world and make it better. But I get to build this eternal kingdom that Jesus is king over. He's made me useful and important. And you start to see that, and that gives you courage. Because it's no longer dependent on you and you believing in yourself in this amorphous, undefined, foggy way that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. Sometimes you're on top of it and sometimes you're not. All that comes from looking at him. It comes from beholding him and who he is and what he's done for you, what he's gifted you with, how he made you, how he shaped you. Self-confidence is a lie. Not dealing with your insecurity will cause you to hurt people. It will. It hurts people, not just you. You'll be like Saul, who brought a lot of destruction to his life, all the while feeling like a victim. He's defending himself to Samuel. It wasn't my fault, Samuel. You just don't know. Did you not know that the Philistines are here? Have you seen how many there are? And everybody's leaving. How are we supposed to win? I have a responsibility to the people. I have to be responsible. I have to be a leader. I'm the king. So I had to do something, and so I did something. He always feels like a victim. Meanwhile, he is destroying his legacy. You'll hurt people, push people away, alienate those that love you, and all the while you feel victimized by your own actions. Isn't that a weird thing about rejection? You feel rejected and unloved, insecure about yourself, which causes you to reject people, which causes them to reject you, which causes you to feel rejected, so you reject people again. It's really gross. And if you live that way long enough, you think it's normal. You start to think, no one likes me. There's something wrong with me. No one likes me. No one connects with me. And you start to find rejection in the weirdest places. And people look at you like, what are you talking about? No, I love you. What? Why are you acting like this? It's because of that weird self-defeating thing. It makes you jealous and self-defeating and double-minded. This is a picture, I think, of what Saul is like. And it's why Saul does what he does. It's one of the few times in Scripture where we get enough insight into what's happening in somebody's heart that we don't have to infer anything. Samuel tells him directly, you don't think much of yourself. The antidote is not to try to think more of yourself. The answer is to think more of Christ and consider what it means to be defined, shaped, and valued by Jesus. 1 Corinthians 6 and 7, Paul build a theology on the idea that you were bought with a price. Ever thought about this? It's a wonderful, I think it's a great antidote. That one idea is an antidote to insecurity. Because it means you don't belong to yourself, you've been purchased. So it's not about you. It's not about, if I just read it, take a good personality test and discover what a gem I am. And my great potential, then I'll be okay. It's not about you, right? You have been purchased. You are a slave to Christ, a slave in all that means. He's a really good master. He's pretty great, but you a slave to Christ, right? But it also means you've been purchased with a price. What's the price? The death of God. Jesus died. That's a pretty high price. That makes you pretty much a big deal, doesn't it? You must be pretty important. How do you know what something's worth? What is somebody willing to pay for it? If I have a piece of junk car that has no power anything, no power windows, the engine is terrible, it's a piece of junk, but somebody's willing to pay $1 million for it, stupid as they would be for paying $1 million for it, we would say that's a pretty valuable car. Why? Not because of the features, because of what somebody was willing to pay for. I don't know why they'd be willing to pay that, but they were. It was valuable to them, so they paid it. And I'd be going around going, yeah, I used to own this amazing car. It's worth $1 million. I sold it, made $1 million, right? Jesus paid the ultimate price for you. He died. God died for you. Now, what would that do to your self-esteem if you actually believed that? And really took it in. Because you wouldn't have to feel good about yourself anymore. You just feel good about the price paid for you. And let that define who you are and define your value. Genesis says that you're made in the image and likeness of God himself. What a tremendously deep, wonderful idea that is. That you reflect and carry the glory of God. Just by breathing. Just sitting there right now like a lump. You are right now reflecting the glory and greatness of God. People look at you, the angels look at you and they go, that's what God looks like. That reminds me of God. What?
I'm just sitting here like a lump. Yeah, somehow your value's in that, not in your wonderfulness. I always tell you, I think it's true, God did not look ahead in time and see your great potential and therefore save you based on your wonder, what you could accomplish. Well, wow, that Jamie, he's going to be wonderful. Look what he's going to do. He's capable of so much. I think I'll save him. He'll be a real asset in my kingdom. No, he didn't. He said, look at Jamie. What a mess. Man, that boy needs some help. You know what I could do with him, though? I could take that broken guy and turn him into something amazing. Just wait and see what I'll do, right? You cannot behold the truth for very long and have your low self-esteem survive it. You can't. So if you're insecure this morning, I just want to tell you, stop it, number one. But the way you stop it is you behold Jesus and who he is and what he's done for you and what he's given you. You worship him, you express gratitude towards him, and that the way you view yourself is going to change. And stop going on a fool's errand of trying to look in the mirror and tell yourself how wonderful you are and hoping it'll stick one day, because it won't. You're just lying to yourself anyway. Just believe in Jesus, and he will transform the way you see yourself. And that way you avoid destroying your legacy the way Saul did. Right? Why don't we stand up and pray together? God, I just thank you that you using me or any of us to do great things is not dependent on our ability or our performance or even our potential. It's just dependent on your grace. And God, thank you for the example of Saul. God, we see so much of him and ourselves. And it's kind of scary. So we ask you now by your Spirit that you would turn our eyes, the eyes of our hearts to you. God, especially for those of us who don't have very much confidence. God, for those of us who have been beaten down by life, by other people, who were never encouraged as kids, who were never told to just go for it when they were little. And those of us who were abandoned or neglected or abused, and just have a really hard time seeing a future that has any blessing in it. And God, whose enemies always seem so big. God, I pray for those especially in this room that are in that place. God, would you turn their eyes towards you? God, would you reveal yourself to them as their sovereign Lord and King and Maker? And God, that you had died for them. You paid a tremendous unimaginable price for them, not just the world, but them specifically. God, I pray that they would see you and see the gifts you've given them. God, that they would be shaped by you and your grace and not by their own effort or their own performance or the words of others. God, the encouragement of others or the discouragement of others, but they would be shaped and honed by your grace and your death for them and your resurrection. God, free all of us from making fear-based decisions. God, free all of us from impatience and fear, like looking at our enemies and making them bigger than they are and not being willing to wait for you to come and bless us. God, show us what that means in our life right now. Everybody's got different circumstances, different things, different enemies going on. Different versions of this story happening in every life in this room. So God, I pray that right now you would show us what that means in those situations, what it means to trust you, what it looks like to wait on you. God, keep us from operating in our own strength. Keep us from ever saying to you, we got this from here. Free us from those lies and that deception right now.